It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A common complaint we hear about the millennial generation is that they refuse to grow up. But our next guest says that's not really fair, because for working class adults, people entering adulthood, the challenges they face can be overwhelming.
Jennifer Silva is a fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the author of the book Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. Jennifer, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's start with what the conventional markers are for becoming a grown up.
Sure. So when we think about an adult, we generally think about someone who has moved out of their parents' home, who's finished school, who's gotten a stable job, gotten married, and maybe bought a house and started having children.
And in researching your book, you talked to a number of people at the stage of life where they might expect those things to be happening. Did you find that those markers apply in their lives?
I didn't. So I spoke to people in their mid-20s to early 30s. So people you would expect to have kind of at least moved out of their parents' house and maybe gotten a job. But what I found was that for these men and women who are from pretty disadvantaged or working class backgrounds, they can't really count on any of these markers. So maybe they'll move out of their parents' house, but they'll move back in because they lost their job or their hours got cut, or maybe they got hurt at work and didn't have health insurance and kind of got thrown off. So what I found was that people have to kind of redefine adulthood because these standard markers don't apply.
Can you tell us a couple of the stories from the book about what exactly is facing some of these people we're talking about?
Sure. So one of the big themes in the book is that these men and women, they understand that they need to go to college in order to get a good job. They know they can't just go get a job at a factory like maybe their grandparents or even parents did. But over and over again, I heard the stories of people who would go to college but would have so much confusion and bewilderment when it came to paying for college or choosing a major or using a major to get a job that they felt very betrayed by the system. So one woman named Diana dropped out of college halfway through, owing $80,000, but you know couldn't envision how she would use her criminology degree, so she dropped out and got a job selling coffee, and is still there many years later.
And also, I think you start the book with the example of someone named Brandon. Can you tell his story?
Sure. Brandon is a very similar story. His parents were maintenance workers at a university, so he grew up thinking about education as what he called the land of milk and honey, and he got not only an undergraduate degree, but he also got a master's degree in psychology, hoping that he would be able to get a white-collar job, buy a home, be stable. But, you know, for the last 11 years, he's been working the night shift at a service sector job. And he's kind of given up on this promise of adulthood. He told me he doesn't even date anymore because he says women don't want to stay home and eat Burger King and sit on the couch. They want to go out. So if I can't afford that, then I just have to make do with what I have for now.
What's interesting about, you know, people like Brandon is that, you know, he could look at society and say, you know, it's a system. That's the problem. I'm not the problem. But it seems like a lot of these people are just taking it on themselves in terms of the burden of the guilt.
That's right. So I would ask them, what is your biggest risk? What's holding you back? And I was very surprised that they said, me. It's myself. Brandon says, if I would move to another city, maybe I'd have a shot at getting a better job and I'd be able to support myself and I'd be able to get married. So they really do think that if they would just take the right risks and make the right investments, then they could have that American dream.
And one theme that emerges, you mentioned the sense of betrayal. I did the hard work, I wasn't a slacker, I went to college and I didn't make it through, or there's no job when I get out. And that rising as a greater sense of a lack of trust in other people and a sense of isolation. Can you talk about how common that was as a theme?
Yes, there really is this sense of a broken social contract. So especially with education, but with many other government institutions as well, people feel like they work hard, they follow the rules, or they try to follow the rules, but they end up feeling like they've been tricked. You know, maybe someone in Massachusetts wouldn't have signed up for mandatory health care and would owe the state money, and they'd say, I just feel like I can't get ahead. I feel like I've been tricked. And this, it translates into this sense of distrust. Like, they learn that if they depend on other people or trust other people, they're just going to get hurt in the end. And so being an adult in some ways means cutting off ties and realizing that you only have yourself to depend on.
It sounds like college figures prominently in that failure, that broken social contract. And there's been a lot of opinion pieces out and books written lately about how it's not true anymore that college is the ticket to a good life, a decent living, and a house and a family and all of that. So is this something that, you know, society is adjusting to right now, that maybe just college is not what it once was?
I think so. The college landscape has become so competitive and confusing and also expensive that it's not about going to college or wanting to go to college, but more about where you go and how you use your degree. And for the men and women I spoke with, they have very little, if any, guidance. And so they might not know how to tell the difference between a for-profit school and not-for-profit school. They might not understand that your major doesn't dictate your future job, so they'll drop out if they don't understand how the major would lead to a job. Or maybe they have trouble filling out their FAFSA, or their parents don't even want to fill out the FAFSA because they don't trust the government and they don't want to give away their information. And so for them, education is not this pathway to mobility, but actually it's a barrier in many ways.
And you compare the working class people you talk to with people from the middle class, and it seems like there's a real difference in resources. Someone from the middle class, they may have access to better education, parents who are willing to stand up for them and advocate with a teacher or a principal, willing to help them figure out how to get into college, a financial resource as they get through college, maybe after. And what about the people you talk to? Are those resources there?
No, it's such a stark contrast for the more privileged young adults. You know, their parents might pay for college. They might subsidize an internship so they can figure out what they want to do with their lives. They might provide all kinds of activities that make them, you know, look more attractive to an employer or a college. But for the men and women I spoke with, their parents don't have that knowledge and those resources to give them. And the, you know, the communities that they grow up in, they don't really provide them with other kinds of mentors. So they don't have someone in their neighborhood or, you know, their church or their school saying, you should apply to this school, or this is how you pay for it, or this is a great career track. And so they really just are on their own and very much in the dark when it comes to trying to figure out how to be competitive in the coming economy.
So if these traditional markers of adulthood, things that used to work, like going to college and getting a decent job, getting married, buying a house, having a family, if those things aren't happening for this working class generation, and at the same time there aren't these blue-collar jobs that used to provide job security and health insurance, what's taking the place for these people? Where do they go?
That's a great question, and I was very surprised that the vast majority of the men and women I spoke with, they told these very individualistic and kind of emotional coming-of-age stories where instead of saying, I got married, I bought a house, I moved out, they would say things like, I overcame my addiction, or I battled my depression, or I realized I grew up in a troubled family, but I got over my past. And so instead of looking outside at the world to measure adulthood, they were really turning inward and measuring their progress on this kind of level of emotional or self-growth.
A therapeutic story, it almost sounds like.
A therapeutic story of sort of self-help and self-transformation.
Now, a lot of people now have been writing about income inequality in America, and that it's just, some people say, not possible to really pull yourself up by your bootstraps the way you used to be able to do and to surmount the class that you were born into. Do these people see any of that narrative now, or is it just all like you were talking about, turned inward?
Well, they don't want to recognize structural barriers in some way. They want to believe that if they work hard enough, they can make it. And they still really hold on to this idea that anyone can work their way up. Someone said to me, you know, my grandfather dug ditches, and now he owns a really big house, and I can be like at that too. I just have to work harder. And so they haven't given up on the dream. But when it comes to telling their own story, they can't tell a story of triumph economically. So they rely much more on these individual markers.
We're talking right now to Jennifer Silva. She's the author of the book Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty.
And we want to know, are we talking about your story? Is she telling your story? Are you in that mid-20 range and feel like you haven't hit adulthood? You can't hit those markers, marriage, steady job, graduate from college. Do you consider yourself from a working class background? What has your experience been? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking to Jennifer Silva. She's the author of Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. And we'll go to the phones now and go first to Jeremy in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I was just calling to throw it in there. The question was put out right before the break, how we felt about hitting markers, people in their 20s. I'm 24, and I'm a high school dropout, and I'm a carpenter now, and I work 7 days a week pretty much, and we've been able to hit those markers, I guess, me and my wife. We have two kids, and the oldest is three. We bought a house 2 years ago, but it takes a lot of work, and it is kind of scary, though. I mean, at times, my wife works also. She's a third shift nurse, so... You know, we're definitely working our tails off, but we're able to do it. But it's hard, I guess.
Right. Well, thank you so much for calling with your story, Jeremy. It sounds like Jeremy and his family, they're hitting these markers. We're talking about it, but they're working really hard for it. Is that something else that you saw?
Oh, yes, definitely. So there were some people I spoke with who had been married, and it was a constant struggle. And in particular, it's very difficult to balance the obligations and duties of work and also, you know, take care of your family, right? So if both parents are working, that causes a lot of added stress about who takes care of the kids, who helps the kids with their homework, how to have dinner on the table, who does all the housework. And so it kind of just added this layer of stress into people's lives.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call.
Oh, we'll go back to the phones now with Stephen in Madison. Stephen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to provide kind of a counterpoint and then and a thought, but I consider myself a middle class now. I'm 27 years old, and I work and live in Madison now. I came from, my parents were working class, made less than $40,000 a year, raised five children on that. My grandparents were all poverty class. Made really little and were homeless quite a bit. I just wanted to say that the way that I see our path and through the three generations of my family and all of my siblings went to college and seem to be successful middle-class people now is that it really starts at home. And I remember from as young as I was, my parents taught me that education and hard work are the most important two values that any person can have. And I'm not sure where my parents got that, if they got that from their parents. Somewhere along the line, it has to start. And if you have things like generational poverty, it's really difficult to get those things to start in communities, especially when entire communities have generational poverty as the norm. So I just wanted to provide a counterpoint. My grandparents were in poverty. My parents were working class, very low class, and now all of myself and all my siblings are middle class.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Steve. And so Jennifer, he's making the case that it isn't so much necessarily the economic resources of your parents if you're working class as the message they give you and the cultural message. Did you see that in the stories you heard from the people you talked to?
I think it's all very closely connected. Many of the men and women I spoke with were growing up in very fragile and often chaotic families. And some of this fragility had economic roots, right? When, you know, fathers would lose their jobs and families would fall apart, or, you know, the stress of making ends meet, you know, maybe people would turn to alcohol or drugs. Whatever the case may be, yeah, it's true that growing up in a fragile family did impact these young men and women. It made it very hard for them to plan for the future or to believe that they should have hope. At the same time, I do think it's important to think beyond the individual family and say, you know, what kinds of social safety nets might we be able to provide for people who don't have that strong foundation with their parents? You know, what kinds of institutions, whether neighborhoods or, you know, churches or communities, could we think about rebuilding so that, you know, maybe a kid can't turn to their own parents for help, but can we go beyond that?
Jennifer, how aware do you think colleges are that they seem to be, you know, just based on the section of adults that you interviewed for your book, that they seem to be failing a certain group of people?
That's a really good question. So it seems to me like That's a really good question. I hadn't quite thought of it from their end. You know, from the stories I hear, it does seem like the administrators in the college or the teachers don't quite maybe understand the kinds of barriers that these young adults are facing. In some ways, the barriers are invisible because if you're part of the system, you can't imagine how hard it might be to just fill out a form or just sign something or just sign up for class and get there on time or buy your books. But on the other end, the men and women I'm speaking to, you know, it's almost like a foreign world to them that they're navigating. And so what seems like very simple tasks or expectations are actually really, really hard to accomplish.
Well, I think you tell the story of one of the people you talked to who had to drop out for a while to take care of an ailing parent and found the college review board when she wanted to get back in very unsympathetic.
That's right. He felt like he had to go before this panel of five people who were not sympathetic and try to convince them. And, you know, at the same time, I'm sure those people hear these stories all day long and they have busy lives and they're tired and maybe they didn't seem as sympathetic. But to him, having to go before this panel, you know, having believed that education was there to kind of help him make it in life, and then to feel so betrayed and let down, you know, it's really lasting. Like, he still speaks about it with so much humiliation and pain.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got John, who's joining us from Waukesha. Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to share my small story and a short question. I've hit a few of these markers, got a house, got a wife, holding my career quite well, but I still don't feel like an adult, and I was wondering if that was a common thread for anybody else as well.
Interesting.
For me, yeah.
No comment. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think it's harder to feel like an adult these days for some reason? I'm not sure what it would be because of, you know, someone like John, he's got the house, he's got a wife, and maybe he's thinking of starting a family, he's got a decent job. Why does adulthood seem like something, you know, a moving target that you never quite hit for so many people?
That's a really great question. And I wonder if maybe it has something to do with, you know, whether there's been a decline in the kinds of institutions that recognize adulthood. So do people feel like, you know, buying a house or graduating or getting married is not being recognized in quite the same way that maybe it had been, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. And I also wonder if maybe these markers have become less stable. So, for example, you get married, but, you know, we're all very aware that, you know, rates of divorce and family dissolution are high in our country. And so even if you've achieved that, you kind of have to work to keep it going. And so maybe it's like you can't really count on it.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. We've got an email from Lauren. She writes, I graduated from college last year at 28. I followed my boyfriend to Madison so he could follow his career, but I haven't been able to find a regular career-focused job. Now I'm looking at giving up the idea of a house, marriage, and kids right now so I can move to find a real career and pay off my massive debt. Sometimes you may have to choose one form of adulthood or the other. You may not end up with a whole package in the end. Is that a common story that you heard, Jennifer?
It is. I think you have to choose different pieces, and they can be very disorderly, and they can even be reversible. So maybe you have to move to find a stable job, but that means you're choosing that you can't stay with your family, or you're you know, having to leave behind a home that you bought. And, you know, that happened. People would try to get a better job to support their kids. Maybe they'd join the military, but then they'd end up being deployed, so they couldn't fulfill that role as parent the way they wanted to. And so I do think it's sort of a balancing act. And if you can get one or two, you kind of feel lucky.
You know, ultimately, if working class young adults aren't able to make it in college and they end up with lots of debt, I imagine fewer of them will try to go to college and we'll end up with, you know, an educated middle and upper middle class and a more stratified society. Is that where you see this heading?
That is where I see it heading. I see a sort of middle and upper class society who grow up with all the tools and the resources and the social ties that they need to succeed and to, you know, get good jobs and get married and stay married. And then you have the other half, the people I spoke with who are kind of giving up, who don't know where they'll be employed next week, who, you know, are so afraid of getting hurt or being disabled and not being able to work, who, you know, are in and out of relationships and in and out of housing situations, and not really knowing what that stability but feels like.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Jennifer Silva. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Her new book is Coming Up Short, working class adulthood in an age of uncertainty. And if you still have a story to share about what we've been talking about, you can always do that at the Central Time Facebook page.
Next is the news, and then we'll hear from the vice chair of the 9/11 Commission about how the United States can streamline national defense.
And we'll hear the story of one of the first victims of the September 11th attacks in 2001, who created the internet that, or helped create the internet that told the story of September 11th.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a victim of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, who is also a mathematical genius who transformed the internet.
But first, we're talking about a report out today from a bipartisan commission saying our national defense oversight needs to be streamlined.
We're talking with one of the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission about how our national security has changed since the 2001 attacks and in what ways we might still need to change.
Our guest is Lee Hamilton, director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University. He was vice chair of the 9/11 Commission and a former U.S. representative from Indiana. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
What have you been thinking about today? It's September 11th, an anniversary of, obviously, that horrible day in 2001. You chaired the 9/11 Commission. What's been on your mind today?
I think uppermost on my mind is the victims and the family of the victims. During the 9/11 Commission report operations, we met frequently with those people. I think, by and large, the families of the victims have responded constructively from that horrible tragedy, and I got to know many of them well. I've been thinking a lot about them today.
And you've been calling for some changes in the way that we are handling the way the U.S. is prepared for a future terrorist attack. What do you think needs to change?
Most of our recommendations of the 9/11 Commission were adopted either in whole or in part. One that was clearly not adopted was our recommendation as to how the Congress should oversee the Homeland Security efforts. Congress has really got a very large number of overlapping committees and subcommittees that oversee the Department of Homeland Security, and when you have that many, you really don't have much oversight at all. We think the American people would be safer and more secure if the Congress were to robustly exercise its oversight responsibility with respect to Homeland Security activities.
How do we streamline something like that? What would need to change?
Well, it's not all that complicated. Congress needs to treat the Department of Homeland Security very much as it does the Department of Justice and the Departments of Defense. Each one of those departments of government report not exclusively, but primarily to one committee. And that committee, Armed Services Committee, for example, has primary oversight responsibility for the activities of the department. You need the same thing. Congress simply needs to follow its current examples with regard to Homeland Security to improve the oversight.
Now, there's been a couple examples of how the fact that this hasn't been streamlined has affected us. A couple examples in the New York Times piece that we mentioned were the threat of cyber attacks and also bioterrorism. What's been happening there in those areas?
Well, the Congress deference to the president, the Congress inability to act in those areas, very important areas of national security, means that the president has to act. And the president acts with an executive order, which doesn't have the reach or force of legislation. So Congress's timidity here, its passivity, its failure to exercise its responsibilities, just hands the power to the president. And the president's power grows, the congressional power diminishes as they defer action. I'd like to see, of course, the Congress step up to what I consider its constitutional responsibilities and be a partner with the president in passing such things as legislation on cybersecurity and other important acts of national security.
Now, one of the issues that you have with the way things are set up right now is that it's expensive and that, you know, we're spending a lot of money answering questions instead of, you know, taking care of business. Can you explain that a little?
Well, when you've got 100 committees or more looking and subcommittees claiming jurisdiction over some part of the Homeland Security Department, you have a very wasteful system, very extravagant system. What happens is that Homeland Security people have to take part in, we estimate, almost 300 formal House and Senate hearings over a period of time. In 2009, the Homeland Security people did the equivalent of 66 work years responding to questions from Congress. Every Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, Michael Chertoff, Janet Napolitano, who's just leaving, have complained vigorously that they're just spending too much time responding to congressional questions and requests and requirements. They're spending more time on that than they are executing their responsibilities for Homeland Security. That's an absurd situation. It diverts us from the real task at hand. Can't correct it quickly, probably, but we need to correct it so that you get a more focused oversight of Homeland Security. And the Homeland Security folks are reporting to one committee or at least several committees and not 100.
Well, as you know, the U.S. government is not exactly known for being lean and fast-moving. How would you explain to the American people and to Congress itself exactly what is at stake?
Well, I think the Congress has to understand and the American people have to understand that this business of congressional oversight makes a lot of difference. Congress has two responsibilities, legislation, everybody knows about that, but oversight is terribly important. Oversight ought to be looking into every nook and cranny of the activities of Homeland Security. They ought to make sure the laws are being implemented, that money is being spent in a reasonable, honest way, that you don't have any hanky-panky going on, and that suggestions are made by Congress to improve the operations of Homeland Security, to criticize it, to support it when they're doing something right. Good, strong congressional oversight can greatly strengthen and unify the work of a department. It's present elsewhere. It's not present in this department. It's a correction that has to be made by the Congress, and they ought to get to it.
Well, as you know, Congress is dealing with a lot of stuff right now. We've got Syria, the economy, a looming battle over the budget. How do you call attention to fixing the process when there's so much other stuff that's important, too, on the table?
Well, Congress always has a long list of priorities, and you do what's important. I consider the safety and security of the American people important. I consider no task greater than that that the Congress considers, and I believe what we're suggesting here, you refer to it as process, and that's correct, of course, but getting the process right means you get the result right more often than not. So let's get the process right. Sure, it has other priorities. They're all important, but that's the business of the Congress. They've got to sort through these priorities, got to make more progress than they are on all of them. Surely they have to make progress on this one, because directly at stake here is the safety and security of the American people. What other function do they have more important than that?
Well, I thank you so much for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
We've been talking to Lee Hamilton, director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University. He was vice chair of the 9/11 Commission.
Coming up next, a look at the man who may have been the first victim of the September 11th attacks, a math genius who transformed the Internet. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Almost 3,000 people died on the morning of September 11th, 2001. One man, though, Danny Lewin, was almost certainly the first victim of those attacks.
He was on board American Airlines Flight 11 and was reportedly stabbed to death while trying to stop the terrorists from taking control of his plane before it hit the first tower of the World Trade Center.
Danny isn't only remarkable because of his actions on September 11th, 2001. He was also a mathematical genius who created a billion-dollar tech company, which ironically proved critical for communications in the days after the attacks.
Reporter and author Molly Knight Raskin is here with us now to talk about the life of Danny Lewin. His book is called No Better Time, The Brief, Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, The Genius Who Transformed the Internet. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's such a remarkable story. What got your interest in telling Danny's story?
Well, I first heard about Danny around the 10th anniversary of 9/11. A friend of a friend told me some fragments of his story, and as a freelance journalist, somebody asked me to produce a short documentary tribute video to him for the 10th anniversary. And at that time, I just thought, I heard all these various disparate pieces of his life, his actions on 9/11, but more so the way he lived and what he created, and I thought to myself, why don't more people know this story? And from there, I just became determined to tell it in full.
Well, let's begin on the last day of his life. Why do we understand that he was the first victim of the attacks?
Well, what we know from the facts as gathered by the 9/11 Commission is that the passenger on that flight in seat 9B in business class, which was Danny's seat, was stabbed by one of the terrorists who was seated behind him. We know there was some kind of a struggle that concluded in that stabbing. Beyond that, the facts are scanty, really. And so I do use the word almost certainly the first victim because we'll never know for sure exactly what happened on that flight. But what I did with the book was take the evidence from the 9/11 Commission and combine that with two facts about Danny, one of which was that he served in the most elite counterterrorism unit of the Israeli army and was trained to hunt and kill terrorists. And the second part was interviews with more than 100 people who knew them who said he would have never, ever gone down without a fight.
And that's something that struck me reading your book is that everybody you talked to said, yeah, that sounds like Danny.
Yeah, he was someone who really relished in competition and relished in arguing and was rather combative and also physically extremely strong. Again, a trained warrior in this elite unit. And so there's really no doubt in my mind after interviewing so many people, even people who served with him in the army in Israel, that once he had some inkling of the terrible thing that was about to happen on that flight, that he made a plan to do something and he jumped into action.
And let's talk about one of the other remarkable parts of his life. What did Danny Lewin do for the internet?
It's really a remarkable story of what he did in his life. I mean, he died at age 31 in those few years before his death, he wrote a set of algorithms for his master's thesis at MIT, and he used these to transform the internet with a company he co-founded with one of his professors called Akamai Technologies. And it's not a well-known name today like any of the big giants in computing, but the company he created made the internet a better, faster, functioning internet. And at the time when he invented these algorithms, the internet was moving very slowly and crashing a lot because of congestion. And he developed something that made it faster and better and turned it into a multi-billion-dollar company in his late 20s.
Let's talk a little bit more. We don't need to get too technically detailed, but as you described, and I remember those days, if more than 20 people, it seemed like, went to the same website at the same time, it got very, very slow. How did he tackle that problem?
He tackled the problem using complex theoretical math. And so basically what he did was write this set of algorithms and used those to create a sort of a magic layer, they call it, on top of the internet. So Akamai itself set servers up around the world and then programmed these servers with their intelligent software. And that intelligent software was and still is able to route content and data through channels of the internet that are not congested. And so it basically was like a FedEx of the internet. And the underpinnings of that technology programmed into those servers came out of Danny's master's thesis.
And you describe Lewin and others as well as a mathematical genius. Where did that come from? Did you get a sense from him growing up, from his life, why this mathematical genius developed?
Definitely. I mean, he understood math at a level that is so complex that, you know, there have been those who have written extensively about it and argued that it is innate. And there's no doubt but that Danny's family, his parents were both extremely intelligent. They were doctors. They fostered in all of their kids an enthusiasm for intellectual curiosity, for math and science, for learning about computers when just the first PCs had come out. And so he was not only innately gifted, but he was brought up that way. And then that gift really came into view when he attended graduate school, first in Israel and then at MIT. And even then, when he was at the two top schools for science and engineering in the world, those around him said, "This is one of the smartest guys I've ever met."
In talking to people about his career, do you get a sense of the lost potential of what he would have done if he hadn't died in the September 11th attack?
Definitely. I think that's the question that, to this day, haunts everybody who knew him well. He died so young, and he accomplished so much before his death that it's hard not to wonder what he could have accomplished. And, you know, he wasn't a household name, but he created something that most of us use every day when we log on to the Internet for things like Facebook or iTunes. And it's the magic that keeps the Internet up and running. And it's something that he would have probably taken and built on for the rest of his life. He was someone who never slowed down. And so there's also no doubt in my mind he would have done great things had he lived beyond such a young age.
Would he be a household name, do you think, like the late Steve Jobs, say, or Bill Gates?
I think so. You know, I think so personally, but I also interviewed a lot of people in technology and business who are giants themselves, co-founder of Yahoo, founder of Ticketmaster, and all of them believed that he would have been. And so I think that there's good indication from what I think his trajectory would have been that we would have known him as a household name.
How ubiquitous on the Internet are the things, the algorithms he created? Is it something that everybody uses, or at least uses something inspired by what he did?
Oh, sure. I mean, Akamai now is a huge company. It's a multi-billion-dollar worldwide company, and at any moment they control or work with 30% of the Internet traffic around the world. And again, a lot of these giants, these names and technology that we all take, you know, sometimes take for granted, their speed and efficiency, and they run on Akamai. They run on Akamai servers. So we do use that technology every day, and it's got this lasting impact that is pretty extraordinary. It hasn't changed much. And sure, now today there are competitors and there are people who do similar things, but Akamai has sustained itself throughout many years of economic upswings and downswings and still managed to stay afloat and be successful. And if you ask people there, a lot of them will say it's because of Danny.
You talked to a lot of people who knew him professionally and personally. What was he like as a person?
Well, the thing that really attracted me to writing about him and writing a book about him is that he, despite the fact that on paper, you know, it just looked like everything he touched turned to gold. I mean, it was almost, you know, when I approached this, it was like writing about someone who was superhuman. This guy was so brilliant. He was so physically agile. He was so gifted. He became such a keen businessman. He had a quick wit. He was a nice guy. But he was also really complex, and that's why I really enjoyed writing about him. I think he was someone who this sort of speaks to the title of the book. He really never wanted to waste one minute. And even at such a young age, he was just squeezing the life out of every second of every minute of every hour of every day. And I found that really fascinating, just what that kind of drive and where it comes from and how he got it, which is really what I try and get to in the book. And it was really inspiring to me to write about somebody like that. And, you know, maybe that was also, you know, it has its downsides too, which is that he didn't get to spend as much time with family or friends or enjoying this great wealth that he accumulated so quickly.
In our last minute, ironically, I guess one of the greatest tests of the things he created to help prevent the Internet being congested was the September 11th attack that he died in. How did the internet, how did the people using his technology do with the massive surge of people going online to see what the heck was going on?
Yeah, well, it's the really tragic irony of the story is that, you know, all along for the years that he created Akamai, Danny predicted that someday the internet would see some crush of traffic that the system just couldn't handle and that Akamai would be there to help manage it. And September 11th really proved everything that he said to be true, which was, you know, it proved the 100-year flood equivalent on the web of disasters. And at the same time, Akamai was there to help a lot of really critical websites that people were using to get information stay live that day and not crash. And it was because of Danny's technology that they were able to do that.
Molly, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Molly Knight Raskin. She's a reporter. Her new book is No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. That book just came out today.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll speak with an African-American journalist who returned to his college alma mater to find out why so many students like him never graduate.
We'll also talk about why voting and eating may be more related than you thought. A public health expert who studies food and food politics will give us a lowdown on the political world of the food industry.
And we'll continue our Curious Wisconsin series tomorrow. We're going to take a look at Ripon's Mystery Cave.
That and a lot more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, it's this week's installment of Wisconsin Life, and we'll pay a visit to Bayfield. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.